Hello, this is Denise Yon, and welcome to the Brand is Business Bites podcast. The Brand is Business Bites podcast gives you a taste of insights and information about brands, businesses, and the people who work on them. It's available on iTunes. For more stuff for your brain to chew on, please visit my website at deniseleeyon.com.
Welcome. Today I have with me Les McKeon, who is a serial entrepreneur. He's launched over 4 years from a pizza master license to a graphic design agency and a tool and die manufacturing company, and also one of the leading contemporary art galleries in Ireland, which is his home country. Les conveys the wisdom from these experiences, as well as his work with clients like Harvard University, Pella, T-Mobile, American Express, and his new book, Predictable Success, Getting Your Organization on the Growth Track and Keeping It There. And I had the pleasure of meeting Les through Twitter, I believe, but this is the first time I get to talk to him live, and I'm happy to share the conversation with my listeners, so welcome, Les.
Well, thank you very much for asking me, Denise. I'm delighted to be here.
Great. Well, I had the opportunity to read your book, but I know some of my listeners may not have yet, and so I wanted to give you a chance. In Predictable Success, you outline the 7 stages of growth through which every organization progresses, and I'm wondering if you could just give us kind of a brief overview of those stages as a starting point.
I sure can, but I'm tight because it's a lot to cover in a short period of time. Essentially, what I discovered in launching 42 businesses myself and then advising many, many hundreds more through my incubation, I discovered that every single organization goes through the same 7 stages, and they're really unavoidable. And the stages are relatively intuitive and simple. They start with what I call early struggle, which is pretty self-explanatory. The first 3 years or so in general, I'm obviously generalizing, most businesses are a period of early struggles, very simply a battle to get to a sustainable, profitable marketplace for your product or service before your capital runs out. And that's really the dangerous part for most businesses. There's a very high infant death syndrome in early struggle. More than 80% of all businesses that are started fail within the first 3 years. So just to get through early struggle is a considerable achievement. And for most businesses that come through early struggle, they hit an immediate, very fast first stage growth because there's so much compressed energy and enthusiasm and motivation. And the business hits the second stage, which I've given, again, a highly technical phrase. I call it fun. And it's because it is fun. That's when the myths and legends of the business build. That's whenever victory is constantly snatched from the jaws of defeat. We do anything we can to help the client. We can turn on a dime, very flexible. The big dogs in the organization emerge, people who really work hard and are very loyal and put in long hours to grow the business. And fun feels like it should go on forever, and it could go on forever, but within that success that fun brings with it, but it's even the next stage, which is a difficult stage in which I call whitewater. And what happens with regard to whitewater is eventually the growing business becomes larger and more complex. And the complexity that begins to emerge calls for us and the need for at least a minimum amount of systems and processes. So the visceral management that the founder owners typically have managed with up until this point, we know they're doing everything out of a sense of judgment, which is a great way to run and grow the young business. It begins to get stretched because there are moving parts. And so the organization at that point begins to drop the ball a little bit. It delivers the product. It misses some timetables. And before long, the fund owners realize we need to bring some systems and processes in to bear. If managed that properly, the organization will push through whitewater into the peak of its growth stage I call predictable success. That's a point at which, because of the use of some systems and processes, there's a very high likelihood that goals which the organization set will be achieved. And unlike we humans, the organization in theory can stay at its peak stage, stay in predictable success indefinitely. But the reality is that what tends to happen is the managers, the executives see the benefits that accrue from putting systems and processes in place, and guess what, put them more in place. And before you know it, the business becomes over-systematized, begins to get a little arthritic and creaky. It enters the first decline stage, which I call treadmill, because it's a bit like that. You feel like you're on a treadmill, pounding away but going nowhere. Form begins to take over function. Checklists are very important. They're very important that you fill in the right forms, use the right Pantone color for your logo. And at that point, the organization, if it catches it, the leadership catches it, Considering a minute, we're getting a little too over-stigmatized here. We've got to bring back some creativity, entrepreneurship, some flexibility. And if they do that, they can return to predictable success. If they don't do that, unfortunately, the organization slides into the penultimate stage, which I call the big rut. And in the big rut, the organization essentially has lost its ability to self-diagnose. People like being over-systematized. They don't like anything rocks the boat. Customers are a pain in the neck. You might think about the airline industry as an example, currently very much in the big rut. And the business will eventually become so arthritic and bureaucratic that it will die. It'll hit the final stage, which I call death rattle. But we won't linger there. I spend most of the book talking about how to get from whitewater up to the final stage into predictable success, or if you've slid forward in the treadmill, how to recover and get back to predictable success. So there you go, predictable success in 2.5 minutes.
That was pretty impressive, and I, you know, there is so much depth and richness that comes out in your book, and so I know we're not doing justice to the concepts, but thank you for that overview. And actually, in listening to you talk, one of the things that strikes me is that there's this kind of tension between fun and systems and processes, and it sounds like it's kind of, in some ways, trying to find the appropriate point in this. Maybe there's a continuum between the two, kind of the appropriate point between those two, where you can have both and thrive at that middle point.
That's absolutely right. In fact, the challenge of leadership for an organization that has reached predictable success, and you can do that at any size. You know, I know 20 people, organizations that have just got 20 employees maximum who are in predictable success. GE, who at one point employed 300,000, was in predictable success for many years. It's not about size. What it is about is getting that balance exactly right. You're correct, Denise. And the balance is between, on the one hand, entrepreneurship, vitality, flexibility, creativity, risk-taking, and on the other hand, the rather more restrictive nature of needed systems and processes to ensure consistency and quality. And the two are, in essence, a zero-sum game. If you completely processize an organization, there's no room. It'll squeeze out entrepreneurship entirely. If you just take the view, there are no holes barred, everything goes, we don't need any systems and processes, then entrepreneurship, creativity becomes overblown. The organization takes far too many risks. We saw this in the financial industry over the last couple of years, and it'll blow up eventually. So keeping that balance right between creativity on one hand and reasonable adherence and process on the other, that's what provides the framework to really have fun, sustainable, scalable, so you can have fun in the organization, but you're building a business. You're not just self-aggrandizing or you know, yourself, you're actually building a scalable, profitable business and have fun.
That makes a lot of sense. Now, as a brand person, I'm always curious about how and when and why brands get developed. And so I'm wondering, from, you know, all the work that you've done, is there a point in an organization's progress where it makes most sense for the leaders to really focus on developing the brand?
Well, I'm not a brand expert, Denise. That's one of the reasons why I follow you so avidly and follow your Twitter stream and your blog, because you've got such a wonderful understanding of the role of branding. But what I have done over the years is I've observed what has happened a lot, and I can certainly pass on my observations, and they're this, that what happens in fun in the early growth stage is that that great success and the fact that this is flexible and can be almost anything leads owner managers often to believe that they have defined their brand successfully because everything goes well, that what they're doing at that point in essence encapsulates the brand. I'm going to have to apologize. I'm speaking to you from my wonderful home office, and my wonderful home dog is squeezing his little teddy bear. So if you hear squeaking behind me, that's exactly what it is. So what happens in fun is that what we do becomes the definition of our brand, and there's a degree of hubris that often creeps at that point, which causes people, against my observation, to overreach in their definition of who they are and what they can deliver. And so what happens is when whitewater hits, first of all, there's a period of denial that happens with any of us when we reach a difficult time, that these things that are going wrong are all accidents or mistakes, and we'll correct all those. But eventually what happens is that the leadership team recognizes, management recognizes, the founder owner recognizes, you know what, we're not, you know, these unstoppable heroes or anything. There are some limits to who we are and what we can do, and those are good to have. And the brand typically gets redefined coming out of whitewater and into predictable success in a much, much more customer-focused, customer-centric, and realistic way. Put it another way, many of the myths and legends that happen in fun whenever we do absolutely extraordinary things because of our commitment, passion, enthusiasm, and flexibility, and our smallness, sometimes mistakenly get translated into performance bars. It's what we set ourselves to be as an organization, and that's unsupportable. So where I see it happening best is whenever the not just the brand, but the mission, vision, and values of the organization gets re-examined as we come back out of whitewater and into predictable success.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, and it seems to coincide with what I've experienced in working with my clients as well, is that entrepreneurial success that happens early on can be very misleading when it becomes to your brand and really, you know, what is sustainable as you scale. So what you've said just makes a lot of sense to me. Now, one of the things that you said also was that as the brand gets redefined, reexamined, coming out of that white water stage into predictable success, you said the company becomes more customer focused. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that and your experience in, you know, in working with entrepreneurs and leaders. You know, how do they become more customer focused? And do they do that easily? Do they do that well? You know, what are some of the struggles that happen in that process?
My observation again, Denise, is that it is a difficult thing, particularly if we're talking about the founder owners of what were smaller businesses that have grown rapidly, who hit whitewater. One of the dynamics, one of the things that happens is that as the business is growing through fun, don't forget the founder owner typically has had a difficult time through early struggle. Everybody says that he's crazy. Family and friends have probably semi-disowned him or her. Getting out of early struggle is an affirmation, in a sense, that they made the right decision, that they're pretty darn good and clever and all that sort of stuff. Then customers start to tell them how wonderful they are because they're small, responsive. They can do things, turn a dime. They start to hear a lot of good news. Hubris comes in. Ego obviously comes into play. You know, I've been through it myself 42 times, and I never learned this lesson any one of those 42 times, and still I started to watch other people. When the news starts to come in, when whitewater begins to happen, and you get the first customer complaint, somebody rings and asks to speak to the boss and says, you know, this is crazy, I'm disappointed in you. You've never done this before. You forgot my order, you dropped it, or you got it wrong. The first time, like I say, is a little bit of denial, and then after a period of time when it's clear we're in whitewater and we're getting a lot of things wrong, one of the things that happens is that the denial period carries on too long. And often the founder owner will cut themselves off from the direct line of information that should be coming back from their customers, and learning to reach out and embrace and accept feedback and put it back into the information pool and use it as data to help you shape how you respond to your customers is a hard lesson for the founder owners to learn. What they try to do is they try to put the genie back in the bottle. They try to get back to fun because they think that's the norm. And what they say is, okay, look, what we're going to do is we're going to make this all go away. We're going to get back to being so brilliant and fantastic and flexible that we'll never make a mistake again. We'll do it the way we did there for 3 or 4 years or 3 or 4 months or however long fun lasted. And they try to go back to the future in a sense, as opposed to saying, you know what, if we're going to build a scalable business, and I'm talking about people who want to really grow their business, we need to listen to the customer, and maybe we need to even, same old song that I've been saying all along, put a system or a process in place to make sure that we do it regularly and consistently, and we listen to that information. Now, just a final point, it's perfectly valid for someone to say, you know what, I don't want to grow a very large business. I really loved it when we were back there and fun, and everybody thought we were wonderful. And I'm going to shut down the second muffler store or the third coffee shop that I opened or the fifth bedding store. And I'm going to just go back to my roots where I can control everything and I can deliver incredibly excellent service day in, day out and get very complaints. That's valid. But if you want to really grow a very scalable business and get up into that predictable success state, then you've got to embrace customer feedback and get a system and process so that it gets to you and you can use that data.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting because I think one of the things that I've heard from a lot of the CEOs I talk to is that one of the struggles they have is that, you know, they say people will stop talking to you. People stop telling you the truth. They start telling you what they think you want to hear as opposed to what you need to hear. You know, and they're talking about kind of as they ascend in the organization, as they get to the CEO level. And what I'm hearing you say is in some ways they may be cutting themselves off without knowing that they're doing that as well, that because they've built this business from through this kind of very fun, exciting stage, they may kind of want to return to that as opposed, and kind of cut themselves off from the reality that they need to face, just as much as the rest of their team is trying to shield them from that reality.
Yeah, I find that the shielding from reality happens much, much more in a larger organization that has slid into treadmill. And one of the key signs of being in treadmill is when you begin to massage every piece of negative data to put a positive spin on it. Now, that doesn't tend to happen in the upside of the curve with the younger growing businesses when they hit, because they're not used to using debt for almost anything. I mean, the business has been run viscerally at that point. So for the founder-owner on the upswing on the growth curve, yes, they tend, in my experience, often to put their hands in their ears and sort of go, na-na-na-na, can't hear you, can't hear you, until they realize they need to listen to the customer. In the very much larger organizations, a clear sign that you're in treadmill is whenever people start bringing reports of the thing we're talking about, in this case, customer service data, and what they're doing is they're slicing it, they've got their Excel sheet out, and they've got 15 pivot charts, try to prove some positive point because they know their boss doesn't want to hear bad data. That's a sure sign that you're in trouble, and in fact, it's one of the things that will push you into the big rut, because if you do that often enough, you numb to reality, and you lose that power to self-diagnose that I was talking about earlier.
Yeah, and that's really, the self-diagnosis is really something that I caught on early in the conversation, and what you talked about in your book is really being able to take a clear-eyed view of how you're performing and why you're performing that way, what are the drivers, and being able to not only see them, but then have the commitment to do something about them is really important as well.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. One of the things that happens when the organization gets to the late stage of fun, right through why we're into predictable success, and it peaks at the start of treadmill, is that leaders, whether they're managers or owners or C-level executives, project leaders, they begin to allow or condone myths to develop about who we are and what we do and how we do it. And whenever you start to manipulate the data to perpetuate the myth, they're in deep trouble, as opposed to saying, let's look at the data and it will tell us how we go to market, how effective we are, how well we're doing, rather than saying, okay, our myth is that we are, the number one most flexible, customer-focused, bakery in the greater Goldsmith area. We've got our mission statement here and we perpetuate that as we are. Let's wrench the data into shape to prove the point. Then you really are in deep trouble.
Right, right. And, it strikes me that I think that having a when a company has a brand that is very clear and very strong, you need to be able to believe in it, push it, and grow it, but at the same time understand that you can't completely delude yourself to the reality. Your brand is really not what you are. It's one thing to say that this is what you are and to aspire to that, but you need to have that reality as well. So
yeah, your brand is what you actually are, and that's what the data will show you. Your brand is not what your brand statement says you are.
Yeah.
The moment you put your brand statement together, it may be true, probably isn't even, but it may be as close to being true at the moment that you first pen it and put it out there. But with a passing second, reality drifts it away, both positively and negatively. You get better at some things, worse at some things. It's really important to get the information. Information is information. Data is neutral. It's just data.
Mm-hmm.
When you start trying to manipulate the data to prove that what you say about yourself is, put prove in inverted commas, you couldn't see me do the air quotes there, but to prove that what you say about yourself is, again, air quotes, true,
right,
then you're not only in treadmill, you're rapidly sliding towards the big mud.
Well, Les, you have given us some really good things to think about just in the short conversation, and I hope that my listeners will take the opportunity to learn more about predictable success, how you get there, and how you stay there. And the way you can do that is to visit Les's site, predictablesuccess.com. And if you'd like to contact Les directly, you can do that through that site. There's a contact page that has all of his contact information as well. But I do encourage you to get the book. It's been, as I was telling Les before we started this interview, it's been, it was just such a great, very practical, applicable book for me. So, Les, thank you so much for your time. It's been great speaking to you. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for today. Thanks for listening to the Brand as Business Bites podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes so your brain will always be filled with good stuff to chew on. For more information or to contact me directly, please visit my website at DeniseLeeYan.com. Take care, and thanks again.